Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I had to read what it was called on the script because I forgot what it was.
Sorry, your name's there as well. Oh, so I'm struggling with that one.
That's really odd. I managed to do that wrong immediately. As you can probably tell, it's not Joe Devine. He's just away this week. It's me, JJ Bull. It's me, you got me. And today I am joined by the one and only John McKenzie. The dog, the human dog. Combined in a laboratory.
Laboratory.
And also joining us today is the human child. Ruben Pinder.
A goo goo gaga.
Ha ha. We combined a child with a man to create this monstrosity. This handsome boy in front of me. Anyway, today on the football, what do you call it again? TIFO Football Podcast, we spoke about Newcastle and how they will evolve, like into a better, like, you know, it would be called if it's.
What would they be if they're
a Pikachu
Pokemon?
Evolve? He evolves into something, doesn't he? I can't remember. I bet Steve knows that.
Who's that? Which
I'm going to cut him off when he starts talking about Pokemon. Oh, no.
Pikachu becomes Raichu.
Oh, yeah. He's coming with that. And then here we go. What's a Pope? That's one of the things we did. What's a Pope going to do with a rhino? Stay tuned for whatever that is. Well run clubs and badly run clubs. Guess which ones are which? Which, you see,
yeah,
I did
that's very Scottish.
Once when I was I think it was nursery, maybe primary school, we had to do a play and I had to like read all the bits because naturally, of course, I became one of the stars of the play because that's what you would do with this monstrosity. And the teacher kept saying you had to say what you must say what and why like that. And it always stuck with me being kind of weird. I remember at the
and
time.
You do, you've said that ever since, have you?
Well, no, only in certain times when I remember what she did it because it makes me laugh because I remember it having
it's
to do
bit
it.
Deep South America, isn't it? Why?
What is your favourite colour? And so that's what we did there. Then in Pentangles and the Green Knight, find out what that is. We react live, genuinely, to the news that Chelsea hired Mauricio Pochettino as their latest manager. Latest is a good word there because, yeah, latest, it sounds like it's always live and always moving on. And then what's the point of supporting a football club? We do talk about that and we discuss it at great length, actually. Then we go on a European tour around the forests of Freiburg, La Playa of Barcelona and other places in Europe. And then who would top a League of Pirates? We tried to stay on football a lot for this and I think we did okay for a lot of it. And
this
then,
intro is making us maybe think that we may be stuck.
No, that the intro's worse than the podcast.
that bullet point list is not entirely representative, but it is a good teaser. So yeah, I think we did a really good job of speaking about football.
I think so too.
So well done, JJ.
I think some great points were made by you and you. Even Steve had great contributions with real knowledge that I liked.
Thank you.
My favourite inputs. Fantastic stuff. And if you like fantastic stuff and inputs and football, then you should get theathletic.com. You should buy the website. And you can read all, if you buy it, you can do whatever you want with it.
Not to be confused with the YouTube IRL channel.
Yes, that's a joke you'll understand at some point soon. But yes, The Athletic, isn't it very good? It's very good, The Athletic. You can read all sorts of things. Seb Stafford Bluer, obviously of these realms.
This parish.
Lives of this realm.
The Seb. Dark realm.
He's written some brilliant stuff all the time, doesn't he? I love Seb's writing. He's there. You can read him. You can read all other... Name some other people you can read, Ruben.
Charlie Eccleshare.
You're always
Tottenham.
Reading it. Yeah, very good, yeah. James McNicholas on Arsenal. Mm.
Laurie Whitwell on Manchester United.
Yeah, that's
Matt
very good.
Woosnam on Crystal Palace. Who? Yes. Who?
Finished above Chelsea. That's Come right. on.
Finished above the teams
below
them.
And if you like
them.
Chelsea, you can read Liam Toomey or Simon Johnson.
And they'll have the inside scoop and all of that Pochettino stuff that did get announced formally today, but they've been doing excellent reporting work. So if you want to read all stuff like that, but like the best version of it, then that's where you go to theathletic.com/Tifo. And then you'll be treated with a surprise, a riddle. And if you can solve the riddle, riddle me this. if free trial there be desired, enter email address and password into the fire. The fire being the burning desire to read The Athletic. That's theathletic.com/tifo for some sort of free trial, I think.
30 days, isn't it?
30 days free trial, and you don't have to pay. And then you just cancel it if you don't like it. You'll probably like it, though. It's free to subscribe on YouTube. That's all I'll say to Tifo IRL and Tifo. And anything else you want to plug, Ruben?
The Athletic FC on TikTok. Follow that.
Is there anything else you want to plug in real life generally that you've done, achieved?
Not at the moment.
That's good.
Stay tuned, though, for
John?
Absolutely not.
Fantastic. It's a long old podcast, this, but as we've established, it's like the second last one, isn't it, in the studio? So
we had to get all the football in when Joe was away, so it's not our fault.
We did actually, genuinely, this is a discussion. We thought because it's a stream, we could talk about lots of football stuff rather than going off rail. There is no mention of any hobbits or...
Eagles. Apart from the Eagles who finished above Chelsea.
And that's it. Yeah, that's what you get. So I hope you enjoy the podcast, which you're about to listen to. I think you will. I liked what I did until that last bit. And so if it makes it into the edit, you'll hear I lost confidence in what I did, which is a thing. So
what was your sign-off be? Go on. You got your final chance to do a sort of your sign-off thing. A bit like in Star Trek where captains have their engage.
Okay.
Or like...
Keep on trucking. So the Premier League season is over and Manchester City are the champions. Let's do a round of applause to the champions.
Well done, City.
Well done to you.
Well done, they're 13.
Yes, that's good. Arsenal were their only challengers, but obviously they fell apart at the end for various reasons, but they just fell apart really, didn't they? And then the Uniteds of Newcastle and Manchester, that's Newcastle United and Manchester United, they finished third and fourth. Man United were third. I've said that the wrong way round. Doesn't matter. We know where they are. They're in the Champions League. That's good for all of those. And what we thought we'd do first is rather than talk about the champions, because we've done that a lot, and rather than talk about Arsenal, because we've done that a lot, and what happened to them, and rather than talk about Manchester United, we've done that a lot, is talk about Newcastle, John. What are Newcastle now? Yeah. Are they good? Are they a Champions League team yet?
I mean, I think they're definitely good. I think if you look at the underlying numbers now, according to FBref, Newcastle have overtaken Arsenal in terms of some of their metrics. So
really?
They're clearly well worth their place in the top four. Yeah. And I think we talked a little bit about this last week, but we talked about this on the video that's just gone on the YouTube IRL channel, the Team of the Season video that we just
YouTube
made.
IRL.
The YouTube IRL. I've never sounded more like my dad than I did in that moment.
On the YouTube IRL channel.
On the IRL channel.
Was YouTube in real life? Is that not just...
Reality.
Real life, yeah, where someone's filming it, I suppose. Which is, I guess, what YouTube is.
Anyway, we talked about Newcastle on our Team of the Season video, which everyone should check out. But we were saying that actually Newcastle are doing things in quite a different way to a lot of the other teams. And there's shades of... Jurgen Klopp's early Liverpool there.
Yes.
And
what shades are there?
I think having really intense out of possession play as a way of controlling games. One of the things that they're doing is using Kieran Trippier as a creative outlet as well. And playing the same sorts of the same sort of structures and trying to get an upside, particularly through that intensity, I think is kind of interesting. Whether or not they take the Liverpool route and continue that way, or whether or not they bring in more technical players, I don't know. But it's quite nice seeing someone else come along and try the Liverpool method out, I think.
Yeah, well, I hadn't even thought of Trippier being like their playmaker, because I mean, what Liverpool did when Klopp came in, he turned Firmino into that false nine kind of player. Mm-hmm. And then slowly over years, had like three players, like key ones each season. So I think, who came in the first season? I should find that out, actually, in Transfer Market. We can find that out.
Because Klopp arrived in the October, didn't he?
He arrived in the October,
he signed, one of his first signings, I think 2016, was Sadio Mane. And then Henderson moved to the base of midfield in 2016.
This is all good.
And then Fabinho arrived maybe 2018. Yeah.
After the Monaco, when
they lost that Champions League final to Real Madrid and Gareth Bale scored, they didn't have Fabinho that season, but they did have him the one after.
Well, I can tell you now because I've actually got the information. Yeah, you're right. So in his first full season, Klopp signed Mane and Wijnaldum. So that's obviously two big players, right? And then I suppose Eddie Howe's done similar in signing Isak as the extra forward.
Guimaraes.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, there we go. So they're halfway to start doing it. So they've got out of possession stuff. In possession, they only keep the ball and play about 52% of the time. That's something that
they don't really waste too much time passing it in midfield either, do they? Like, if you look at the number eights that they play, there's another similarity to the early Klopp's Liverpool where, because Klopp had like Wijnaldum and Lallana, right, who were, in my mind at the time, number 10s. Playing a bit deeper, and Howe likes to play Willock and Joe Linton and Longstaff, who are more kind of direct ball carriers.
And Joe Linton's like Henderson, he's the ball winner. Yeah. That's the thing, he's a lot like Henderson. Weirdly.
I love Joe Linton.
Yeah, he's been great. And then you've got Willock scores really highly for things like ball carrying, so he carries it a lot. So I guess he's more like Wijnaldum in that sort of
left eight role
profile. Yeah, absolutely. And then
I had a long conversation with Mark Carey of The Athletic.
Yes.
And he was saying that he'd done a lot of profiling of Wijnaldum in terms of the data side of things, just to see, because obviously the big question with Liverpool has been what's going wrong with their midfield this season. So how do you find a player who is like Wijnaldum to maybe sort the situation out? And the player who was most closely profiling to Wijnaldum was Joe Willock.
Oh, well, they've got one already. So then that was his first season. The second season signed Van Dijk for a load of money, and that was a real game changer, as well as that was in January, actually, because Mohamed Salah.
Left-sided centre-back.
It's Coutinho.
Like Sven Botman.
Sven Botman, yeah. So then Newcastle are now linked with like getting a right-sided centre-back. I don't know who that'll be. But Mohamed Salah came in that season as a really important player, so they'll definitely sign, I think, Newcastle, either a left or right-sided forward in the summer. Could be a number of...
They did just spend $40 million on Anthony Gordon in January, though, didn't they?
It's a squad player, though. I think that is like signing Oxlade-Chamberlain in Liverpool's second season, because that's a really good squad player. Can play either side, can play as a forward, like inside forward or a winger. So you've got loads of...
Oxlade-Chamberlain, who is now available on a free transfer, by the way, if Eddie Howe wanted to get the same player.
If anyone listening wants to buy him.
Yeah. Other midfielders are available.
I could afford a free transfer, so... I guess it would just come down to the contract they offered him. I don't know what I'd get him to do. Maybe do some research for me or something.
I don't think you could afford Oxlade-Chamberlain.
Yeah, probably not.
I was thinking this right, years ago, because you know they're just footballers, it's their job, right? So what if you were a billionaire and you were like, I'll pay you, Oxlade-Chamberlain, 200 grand a week just to live in my house. Just hang out. Would they do it?
Problematic.
Yeah?
Yeah, probably.
Ill-advised, but not illegal.
Well, they could do it. They could pay the money. Anyway, so Salah and Van Dijk was a big signing. So that's what Newcastle may maybe do next if they develop. But I don't think they'll change. I wonder if they'll deviate from the current kind of tactical setup now, next season. Because when they buy different kinds of players, they can then start to develop a little bit more from what they've got.
The perception of opponents will change. Well, the perception that their opponents have of them will change as well, right? So they'll start to sit back more. And then Liverpool had to adapt to that, didn't they?
Mm. Yeah, and I think they'll go through the same evolution, right? Which is going to be, where are we going to get our creativity from? Which is always going to be an issue for any team that is going to be intense out of possession. Because I guess they're in a nice situation where they can target the out of possession monsters who are also technically adept. I think Liverpool are in the same position as well, but it's so rare that you get that combination of skills in an individual player. So with Liverpool, it's always been like, how do we get more creativity into our midfield without compromising the out of possession stuff. And I think that's going to be the same sort of question that Newcastle are going to have to face in their recruitment.
Yeah. And doing it slowly and patiently, right? So you construct it. So if we go through the signings they've had so far, it's not until the 18-19 season, so after they've lost in the Champions League final, I think.
They lost in 2018, yeah.
Yeah, to Real Madrid, wasn't it? And then that's when Karius had that terrible game. And then Alisson came in with Fabinho, and that was the two. That kind of completed that team. And then you saw Klopp's best team, I think, probably that season. Then they won the league the following season?
Yeah, they won the league in 1920, and they won the Champions League in 1819. And that 1819 team, I think, was actually probably better than the one that won the league. But because of the COVID season, it was all very weird. But that 1819 team lost the league by a point. And they were just unbelievable, like perfect balance. Everyone was at their kind of physical peak.
So do we think Newcastle, if they make two or three big signings every summer from now on, will be Champions League winners within 3 years?
It could happen.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's it feels too early in the cycle for me to be able to make any kind of prediction like that. But obviously, they've gone from a situation where they were fighting relegation last season to competing in the Champions League this season. So clearly their trajectory has been very much upwards. So yeah, what do I know? Maybe that could be the case. But
what do you know?
Yeah, it's a good question.
A 22-point swing from last season.
Yeah, incredible. I think they're the team with the biggest swing. Is that right? In terms of a positive swing upwards? Yeah.
They're definitely the biggest swing. Chelsea have the worst swing.
Whee.
30 points. Yeah. Why was that away?
Well, I just don't like Chelsea.
Oh, I see.
We finished above them, which made me very happy.
We. Tifo.
Is this going to be like that Mitchell and Webb sketch where you're like, you're not actually part of your team?
That is true. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it when John often says we, referring to Leeds, Freiburg. Who else Tifo. You seen before? Yeah.
Notts County.
He's not part of any of them. Mm. Yeah. Notts County, yeah.
Just to bring it back to Newcastle, George Culkin wrote a piece for The Athletic kind of analysing who their player of the season should be. And he asked the Newcastle fans on Twitter, and they all gave loads of different responses, which I think kind of summarises how good they've been as a unit and as a team, and how they've all just been consistently good together, and they don't have like a standout star yet. Like Isak is, you know, biggest signing, probably the most talented, most fun player to watch in that team. But there were shouts for Trippier, Cher, Botman, Burn, Bruno, like everyone.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what positions they target to build on next. Cher is probably right-sided centre-back, as you say, because of age profile maybe.
He's been great though, but alongside Botman, I was thinking it's quite interesting with Dan Byrne, because he's exactly the kind of character that you want to kind of build on and keep in the team, but there are better technical players than him. Like Kieran Tierney is always linked with a move from like Arsenal to Newcastle or something like that, and he would give them something different, but often Byrne doesn't go quite as far forward as the others, which means you can push Trippier on the other side far more forward. But if you take Byrne out, you maybe disrupt that a little bit if you have another fullback going forward, but you also lose some of that. Like, you can't really quantify what he gives you to the team.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it very easy for you to switch into a back three, right? When you've got someone like Dan Byrne playing as a fullback, because you can play him as an outside centre back, and he's 6 foot whatever he is,
6'11".
Tierney could do that as well, though. He can tuck in narrow, but he's just a very different type of player.
And again, completes the Liverpool similarities, right? Having two flying wing backs.
But rather than Robertson, you're saying Tierney.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Tierney and Robertson, and then you've got Trippier and Alexander Arnold, right? They're not exactly the same profiles, but the same sorts of players, right? One of them being like a lung busting runner up one side, and the other one being one of the best ball strikers in the league, right?
It's just occurred to me that I wonder whether there's a chance that Eddie Howe and who's the guy in charge of
Jason
transfers in.
And Jason Tindall. Yeah. Let's make it about Jason Tindall. Yeah.
So I think Jason Tindall has decided that they want to copy that Liverpool model. So they've even gone with like how they can build it with the players they've got. Then they've worked out the players that would go to fit exactly what Klopp did with that Liverpool team. I wonder if that's the thing they've done. I don't know.
Didn't Eddie Howe go and shadow Diego Simeone for a bit before?
Well, he went to haunt Simeone.
he hung out with a lot of coaches, I think, and watched their training sessions, so I'm sure that happened. I'm sure he probably done it with Jurgen Klopp as well. Search for Eddie Howe and Jurgen Klopp, see if anything comes up.
I'm sure.
One of you two please make sense of this sentence for me? Liverpool, Brighton and Aston Villa finished below the teams above them this season.
I think he means last season.
Right. Liverpool, Brighton and Aston Villa finished below the teams above them this season.
Yeah, because the teams that were above them
are above them.
Yeah. And so therefore those teams are below them.
Okay. Cool.
I think this is not true for every team in the league.
It's called tautology.
But it's factually accurate.
Okay, cool. Yeah. That's good. Manchester City finished above 19 other teams, yeah. Well, lovely stuff about Newcastle. Now we know all about Newcastle. Solved them. And we've talked about them now.
As much as we talked about Liverpool at the same time. But yeah. It's a compliment though.
Well, because there's a few teams you see below this part of the Champions League bit where a lot of teams fall into the mid-table now because you've got a top four, which is, you know, there's a traditional top six, which has now changed because obviously Newcastle are definitely there now. And then you go below that. So Liverpool finished fifth this season, so they're not in the Champions League, which is bad for them. They are in the Europa League, which maybe they'll enjoy, who knows. But below them, you've got Brighton, who rose from ninth last season to get into that position there and looked pretty good for it. Aston Villa looked, I mean, when Steven Gerrard took them, or when he left, they were in 17th, I think. Looked absolutely hopeless. And in came Unai Emery and has rescued them, turned them into the second best team in the league, and they finished 7th as a result of being the second best team in the league. Brentford finished 9th. Which was their highest finish ever, except for 1935, when you all knew about football.
Hmm.
Got to put that in there because there are pedants among us. But with Brighton, Villa, Brentford, and now Newcastle, what they've done this season is an idea of an is the idea of an established top six relevant anymore? It probably is, but is it changed now, right?
I mean, the idea of a top six has always been based on finances, I guess, which is boring, and we don't really want to talk about that. But
well, we could say that the economic kind of model says that the team who pays the most in wages, that's where that's who wins. So it tends to go down, you know, step by step, and what you pay in wages is according to a few books, Soccernomics being one, I think. The numbers game maybe is another. So they say that teams with the most money, kind of sounds obvious, but it's not in transfer fees. It's just what you pay players that corresponds with where they finish. So it kind of would make sense if Man City are top.
Yeah.
And so on.
Yeah. But this group of teams is really fun. I think it's one of the most fun top halves of the table for a long time. Really nice seeing Brighton up there. Villa, despite every best effort by their fan base, I still really like them. They've been playing fantastic football. I actually watched their game yesterday against Brighton because I thought that was the most interesting game on. I did switch to the Leeds second half just to wallow in the misery, but I started off with the first half of this game, and they're just two really fun teams playing, both with really strong tactical identities, and that's why I'm going to enjoy watching a game like that, because you can see both teams have ideas in and out of possession. They both have a really clear idea of what's going on. So Brighton doing a lot of their build-up stuff, but Villa under Emery clearly having thought about how do we stop them from being dangerous from build-up situations. And then, I mean, in many respects, both these teams are very similar, right? It's about deep build-up. It's about generating situations where you're going to be able to maximise your chances of being dangerous in attack. And it makes for, I think, really, really fun football. So great to see those two in there. Brentford, I think we talked about Brentford a lot this season, but Brentford, I think, have one of the lowest wage budgets in the league.
Yeah.
So always impressive seeing a team like that and I think for me, Brentford are like the marginal gains team. They are the ones who have sat down and been like, where can we get as much out of our players as possible. So obviously set pieces is a big one.
I mean, that's how, right? Set piece. Like the goal they scored against Man City in the last game of the season is so, so clever. The goalkeeper, David Raya, is pushed up like 30 yards from the opposition goal.
He's basically opposite the bench, right? The coaches are right there, and he's just taking a free kick from just on the sideline there, yeah.
What's it like? You and I have been seeing Brentford a couple of times this season, John, and it's really fun to watch all the set pieces they take, because like this one, for example, if you haven't seen the goal, Raya pushes right up the pitch to be like a winger to take the set piece, which normally, like we're talking about Newcastle earlier, Trippier would hook that into the box, something like that. But with Brentford, there's all these triggers. So there's all these things that happen. Sometimes they'll set up for a set piece the way you think it is, and then that's a dummy because they go into a different shape when the taker steps up to take it. But then that's a dummy because they go back into their actual shape. There's another one after that. So defenders I don't know how you prepare for that defensively. You have to probably do zonal, but then Brentford will have worked out what your zonal marking looks like so they know where to attack. And then there's like the timing of it as well. So it's not just the triggers. Like there's triggers and there's timing, there's positions. So then like Raya takes his free kick really high up, but he knows there's a run being made from I can't remember who runs.
It's Kevin Schade, I think.
So he runs in behind, right? So a really quick player gets in behind to make the cross. and that cross. So everyone then gets distracted by this because you couldn't see this coming. And they've got an overload because the goalie's pushed up, which is that's how you gain an advantage. And then this guy goes out to chase the ball. Everyone looks at him this side of the pitch. So they go over to the left, or City's left. They go to try and adjust to that. Then the ball's picked over to the other side, the opposite side of the box. And is it Mbeumo? Does he head it back across?
Yeah, I think so.
He heads it back across. And because everyone then goes and pushes over to where he is, because the ball's gone that side, they leave a big gap in the middle because they're all pulled apart, and that's where the goal comes from.
Ethan Pinnock.
Big up Ethan Pinnock, because he's come up from non-league.
Dulwich Hamlet legend, Ethan Pinnock.
Because that City played such a high line for that set piece, didn't they? But that was something. Another interesting thing that Brentford do at set pieces I noticed when John and I went to watch them play was they basically quite often throw everybody forward, and they have almost nobody like guarding back, because normally like the fullbacks will just kind of sit deep, and but they just don't bother because I think they're so confident in their routines, like kind of, you know, coming off. And
but doesn't that make sense?
Yeah absolutely,
because think about it,
more bodies in the box, more chance to get a shot away, like,
well, yeah, and all the things you can do, because then you want to, like, the whole point, well, not the whole point of football, but one of the ways you win in football is by gaining numerical superiority in different parts of the pitch. And I was thinking this, I've been playing a lot of Football Manager recently, and on set pieces you're always encouraged to leave people back, you always have one or two back sitting there, but why don't you just put them all up? Because then the opposite, like, the team defending has to bring all theirs back. I haven't seen anyone try and leave, like, a winger or a striker up top to ping the ball to.
Because, what, against Brentford? Because they've got everybody. But yeah, no, valid point.
I mean, if you did, then Raya would just come and clean you out or something like that, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, and it's so much of what you're saying there is it's about trying to get as many advantages as possible. And one of those ways, like you say, is numerical superiority. So if you can get as many people in the box as possible, but then have all of these triggers in order to protect. So you'll always see, whenever you watch that happen, when they throw everyone in the box, there's always two players who will drop out each time to make sure that they're covering the second ball or the ball bouncing out.
Like edge of the box.
Yeah, so it will happen in every attacking free set piece that they take. But it will be different players every time, and they just get so much advantage from that, because you like you say, you're putting two extra players in the box. Make it, even if those two players drop out, you've still made it harder for the opposition to actually read what's going on, and you create chaos in the box. So
that's as much of an attacking move as it is a defensive one, right? Because they're like ready to run backwards if they have to, but they're also waiting for the header that drops to them on the outside of the box so they can shoot rather than. Like, you know,
it's all built around the second ball, right? Yeah. It's the thing Guardiola talked about. It's that massive video in Guardiola, and he talks about in England, it's not just about the second ball, it's a third and fourth. So everything is built around controlling that. And so they have people in position to deal with it, but they also know they can affect where the ball's going to go because they're pulling the opposition back somewhere they don't want to be. I know, it's genius. And then another thing with this, right? So if you're, I mean, all these clubs that will come up, like Luton have come up, right? So they're looking at how they can possibly gain 20 goals a season, 25 goals a season. Do they commit loads of money to try and get a forward who finishes in the box? Or do they spend, well, as much money as they can trying to get someone who can teach set pieces in this way? What's the better thing to do there, John?
Yeah, I'm just searching now to find out the set piece goals. And I don't know how many goals the Premier League actually ascribes to Brentford from set pieces. I know that Brentford's internal models is a little bit broader, I think, than most external models vis-a-vis what a set piece goal is. But you're talking over 20 goals. And if you consider that to be like a form of attacking, you're generating essentially an attacker who is scoring 20 goals. If you're going to spend money on that kind of player, it's going to cost you £50 million or more. So if you can get 20 plus goals out of set pieces in a season, you're saving the need for yourself to buy a £50 million striker, essentially. Yeah. And that's why they do this. But and also, it's the repetitiveness and the repeatability that is so important in these situations, right? It's that for an attacking set piece, you were in control. You versus the defending team, right? And Jurgen Klopp said that when they played against Brentford, it was like the biggest lesson they'd had in how to defend set pieces. But the idea is, as you mentioned, like timing and then all of these different like little quirks they have to actually make it hard for the opposition to. One of the ones I love is they'll just do a bounce pass from a corner, and they'll take exactly the same corner that you might expect straight from a corner kick, but they take it with like 2 or 3 seconds from the bounce pass. And it just changes the timing of everything, right? So if you're a team who's defending and you're expecting a corner to come into the box, as soon as the player runs up to the ball, you're expecting, right, now we trigger our defensive moves.
Yeah.
If the ball is then played to another player who then plays it back to the original taker, you've already triggered your defensive move 2 seconds earlier than you would have done if the ball went straight into the box. So again, you're doing all of these little things. And one of the big things that's been noticed this season is that Brentford are doing this sort of back across corner technique where they play the ball to the back post and then they have the corner taker coming in to become a potential scorer. So you play the ball across, have it headed back across, and then hopefully you've got some of your players who are on the right-hand side outside the box running in to make it more dangerous as well. So it's all about control. It's all about saying, we know exactly what we can do in each of those situations to make it as hard as possible for the defensive team to be able to defend. And I think the thing that really, I suppose, stands out for me, I've completely forgotten what I was going to say. What was I going to say?
It's about dragons?
Yeah, it was about dragons, actually. It was quite hard talking about set pieces because at the back of my mind I was...
Do you think they were real ever?
Yeah, St. George.
Well, they're in old lore, right? So old history and stuff, I mean, tales of heroes. What were those people killing? What was it?
There's a famous...
Is it a symbol? Was it a symbol or something?
There's a famous line etching by some old artist where... I think he was supposed to draw an elephant or something, or a hippo or something. Mm. And they bring it back from somewhere, and it died on the way. And I think he had to just make up what it looked like. I don't know whether or not he drew the dead hippo or whatever,
like a dragon,
when he saw it. But yeah, it doesn't look very much like a.
But they're not green, are they, hippos?
Yeah. But I think back then,
there's
back then you had license to just sort of make things up a bit, didn't you? Like, you know.
I like the idea that... So the idea of dragons first came, we're saying, from someone who tried to take a hippo across.
tried to draw a hippo from memory and got it spectacularly wrong.
And that's just what a dragon...
I think it might be in a rhino, actually.
But, I mean, it's one thing to come up with all of these set piece ideas, right? But it's another thing for Thomas Frank and his coaching staff to... communicate that information to the players in a way that they retain it all and know it instinctively, which I think is possibly the most impressive part of it.
It's almost like turning football into a turn-based game. It's like playing Civilization rather than Age of Empires. So you're trying to make it what it's not, because like rugby's quite stop-start. I would say that's kind of, you know, there's lots of tactical things happen in rugby, especially that you have like set pieces, especially all
and
the
NFL,
bits.
Right, where they have like a
play, that's actually
a literal,
what I meant
a literal
to say, not,
playbook.
I meant to say that rather than rugby. I've got that wrong. So let's just
Same
ignore.
Shape, yeah.
I didn't say that. This kind of thing, right? So they're trying to turn it into that, and then that gives them a huge advantage because everyone else is trying to play in open play.
So Dürer's rhinoceros
is
the name commonly given to a woodcut executed by German artist Albrecht Dürer. Dürer never saw the actual rhinoceros, which was the first living example seen in Europe since Roman times. Instead, the image is based on an anonymous written description and brief sketch of an Indian rhinoceros brought to Lisbon in 1515. But basically, they were bringing this rhino across as a gift to the Pope, but it died in a...
What's he going to do with the fucking rhino?
Stick it in his private...
You can't ride it. Well, maybe.
Could you ride a rhino?
You could definitely ride a rhino.
Yeah. No. Can you?
Be pretty dangerous.
Yeah,
I don't know. You domesticate a rhino, can't you?
What's a Pope going to do with a rhino?
It's a weird gift, man.
Anyway, it died in a shipwreck off the coast of Italy. There you go. Another live rhinoceros was not seen again until a barda arrived from India to the court of Sebastian of Portugal in 1577.
Could the Pope kill and eat this rhino if he domesticated it?
Yeah, I don't know. I bet rhinos don't taste great.
I still don't think this is where the dragons come from. All the way through old history, there's all these like old kings and knights and stuff.
It's actually not a bad picture, considering you didn't see it.
Is it? Well, I mean, for those of you listening to this, it doesn't look like a dragon, though, does it? That's pretty good.
It looks like a rhino, right? Yeah. But my point wasn't that this ended up becoming a rhino. My point was more that I think back then the idea of artistic license was slightly different.
Oh, apparently. Oh, Steve's worked it out. I forgot that you could write things to me on the script. It's not clear when or where stories of dragons first emerged. Yeah, that's what the dragon... That's what Big Dragon tells you, right? But the huge flying serpents were described at least as early as the age of the ancient Greeks and Sumerians, according to Scott G. Bruce in his introduction to The Penguin Book of Dragons.
Just love the idea that penguins are really interested in dragons. Yeah, they've just written a book about them.
I mean, I remember when Joe did first go to the penguin office to start talking about the Tifo book, it was all penguins running the shop. In the ancient world, they took the form of enormous serpents, ready to crush with their coils and kill with their venomous breath. For much of history, dragons were thought of as being like any other mythical animal, sometimes useful and protective, other times harmful and dangerous. Yeah.
Well, they're very useful in Game of Thrones.
That's true.
Why were they all killing them then, all these knights?
I know.
It's very noble.
I like that second mention, flying serpents. That's good. Yeah. Do you follow the Twitter account, Second Mentions?
No.
It's like very funny examples of writers finding new ways to say a thing. I was reading a newsletter the other day and it described jellyfish as venomous blobs, which I found quite nice. Yeah.
There's a lot of symbolism to do with serpents in old ancient civilizations.
Mm.
And there's a Netflix documentary, which I won't say what it is because it'll go down one of my weird rabbit holes again. But it's really good. And one of the theories about what all these serpents represent is to do with meteors and comets falling from the sky because it would have a tail. So they're trying to warn people, in the future what it was, because they love all stars, don't they? All these old civilizations and stuff.
Speaking of the utility of dragons, there's dragons in Lord of the Rings, aren't there? Just saying, maybe they should have sent a dragon.
Lord of the Rings. If we can do it with Star Wars this week, I don't mind.
Okay.
Anyway, speaking of slaying dragons, as in like those bigger than you, like Goliath, you know. So that idea that you kill those that are bigger than you, you shouldn't be able to do it. After the break, we're going to talk about Brighton.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And we're back from the delightful break where we're going to talk about Brighton and not Lord of the Rings, please. John, my message to you on the script is talk about timing and tempo.
Yes, well, we've already talked about timing and tempo, I feel like, in this episode because we've talked about it with respect to set pieces.
Does this mean you're going to do the answer at 140 BPM?
That's right, yeah. I'm going to. It's all about timing, yeah. But I did tweet this weekend just talking a little bit about how I've been quite interested in the concepts of timing and tempo in football, in open play football as well. So Brighton, I think, are a really great example of that. And one of the reasons why people enjoy watching them, as we've already mentioned in the Villa game, this idea of Brighton are trying to bait out opposition teams. They're trying to create space that they can then attack. And one way that they do that is by sitting deep and just slowing the play right down, putting their studs on the ball to almost provoke the opposition to press higher to generate that space. So I think this season it's become really obvious that timing and tempo are really important in terms of how you build up play. But I think it's important in general, and has been for a while at the elite level. So I think a lot of what Pep Guardiola has been trying to do has been about timing. And I think a lot of positional play is actually about timing as well. And I think maybe the fact that it has become colloquially known as positional play has meant that people have focused on the spatial aspects of it. So it's quite easy to talk about, the different channels where you want to have the rational occupation of space. You want to generate space by pulling, either pulling teams apart or bringing them together, which is what happens in the deeper areas. But actually, there's definitely a tempo element there, or timing element as well, because a lot of what you're trying to do in positional play is move the ball through lines of pressure. And one of the ways that you can do that is by particularly using these third man combinations. So often you'll end up with no team is going to go man to man in high areas, right? Because it means that you're going to be exposed at the back. It is happening more and more regularly now, but most teams are going to be very careful not to do that. So one of the things that you can do is you can have a player who sits between two players, right? So you're covering. You might have someone sitting on a pivot player who can then jump onto a centre back if they're holding the ball. These third man combinations mean that you bring another player in to make a triangle, and you can just play it around that the player who's pressing. So the idea being that if you start on a pivot player, you jump out onto a centre-back, you're going to close the passing lane into that pivot player, so you're effectively marking two players at once. But if you bring in a third player, you're making the possibility to just play it around that pressure. And that's a really nice way of making opposition presses very ineffective. And that, you know, that's all about timing. That's about making sure that you have those three players arriving at the right place at the right time so that third man combination can happen. And that's happening all over the pitch for a Pep Guardiola team. Yeah. I think with De Zerbi, we're seeing that happen. We're seeing that become a lot more obvious because so much of it is about actually baiting the opposition towards you, generating space, and then having that really quick tempo change. So really, really slow, lots of patient passing around until you generate the correct conditions in which you're going to do your attacking. And I think that's why people are maybe talking about timing a little bit more. But so much of what I think is the most difficult aspect of football coaching is making sure your players are in the right place at the right time. So positional players, yes, it's about positions, but it's also about having the players in the right positions at the right time as well.
Yeah, and the other thing with tempo as well is, and more Guardiola than De Zerbi, because Brighton are nice to watch, right? And they can control games in certain ways. And like you just said, a lot of the thing with tempo is that Guardiola wants his players not to play at one tempo, he wants to change it. So it's a little more like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a band that would do something like this. Like if you just have the same song over and over again, like every hit in the charts is all the same. It's the same four chords, same sort of thing. And you can guess the melody all the time. So it's very easy to work out. But then Guardiola is a little bit more like
the opening to an Arctic Monkeys concert where they go from Do I Want to Know straight into Brian Storm.
I want to go with like OK Computer and Radiohead or something like that.
Okay.
Where they just start to play with things a little bit.
Yeah.
So then you can even have different time. In fact, like Paranoid Android is a good example, right? So there's loads of like tempo changes within that song. So it's really hard to work out what's going on the first time you hear it, but it's amazing. It's got all the different sections that work together.
And so the choir section at the end where it just like slows right down. And it's
yeah.
Like...
So then, and then you go back to the main riff all the way through. So what you want to do is like destroy teams and we're gonna infringe on copyright if we keep doing that. Yeah.
That was just four notes, surely that's not infringing.
Well, I mean, we can ask Ed Sheeran about it. He's went through that big long copyright case, didn't he, with was
Marvin
that song called?
Gay. Let's yeah. get it on.
Yes,
let's not do that.
Come On Eileen as well, that's another song where you have like a real tempo.
Oh yeah,
down.
Yes,
it gets really fast in the bridge just before the
it's part of what makes it a good song, because if it's just all the way through it, there's all these little changes and that that plays with it. So if we apply it to football, try and not go off road like I normally would, then what you get is, like, if you're playing football, right, and everyone's going at the same pace, often if you just go against the feel of it, it's why players like, obviously, Lionel Messi are amazing, because he'll just not go the same way as everyone. He'll go against the timing of it and against the flow of the game, and that's how you end up getting these spaces, because people haven't read it. People get naturally drawn in, I think, sometimes, into what's going on the pitch, and you just feel that you're part of it. But if you always are able to stay just outside of it and alter the rhythm or the tempo of what you're doing, that's how you get...
It's all about surprising the opposition, right?
I guess that's like, probably the basic
part.
That is
essentially
of it, yeah.
What tactics comes down to is kind of surprise. But a Messi goal that's a perfect example of that, like you say, is the one against Athletic Club in 2015, where he starts to sprint, slows down, and then goes again. And the three defenders that are trying to get the ball off him have reacted to him slowing down, and then they can't react to him speeding up again. Yeah,
exactly, because you catch him by surprise, because you can play with their momentum and what they're going to do with it. So with De Zerbi's Brighton then, how do we see this manifest on the pitch?
I think we see those really quick counterattacks, right, which come from them doing that slow build up. And it changes depending on who they're playing, and their build up structures are always flexible compared to what the opposition are trying to do. But there'll be some games that you see where they just are so slow for a long time. I mean, even in the game against Villa were not wanting to commit. Like I talked to you before about when you have those pressing players who are sitting on a pivot player and then jumping onto the centre-back, they know that as soon as they do that, Brighton are just going to do a third-man combination around them and pull them apart. And so what you're starting to see teams do is just not even commit from that pivot player, just sit on the pivot player and let Brighton have the ball. And it leads to, you know, minutes-long sequences where Brighton are just, you know, not doing a huge amount. But then as soon as that jump is triggered, and they see the space open and they see where they can actually attack it, suddenly the ball ends up moving very quickly through the first third. And then they get the ball and either they have their two nines dropping in quite deep, creating space in behind for the two wide players to run into. And often in those situations, you can just see the ball move so quickly, and it goes from 0 to 100 really, really fast.
It takes a lot of patience to do that from like coaching for the players as well, because there must be an instinct in these players that is like, I want to pass the ball forward, but now's not the time. They haven't had the control that
exactly.
Right?
You can see the pass, you know it's the right one, or like you want to pass it wide, but some players don't understand that the best thing to do to get the ball to the wide player is to pass to the guy who is marked, because he'll put it in, and that takes out three players rather than just one.
Yeah,
I see this in five-a-side a lot. People don't see that easy bit. Like they just wait for the pass and they're stuck on the ball. I mean, so Guardiola was talking about De Zerbi. I'm not sure if he's very effusive in praise, saying that he's affected football tactics a huge amount in the last 20 years, something like that. But then part of what makes Brighton so good is the way the club is run, right? So it's to do with the way that they've structured their recruitment and built around a certain strategy.
I was going to say, before we jump onto like the strategy stuff,
interesting
that you mentioned Guardiola, because I think you can see that Guardiola has been influenced by the way that De Zerbi is playing now. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that Guardiola now has had to solve the problem of how do you play with a player like Erling Haaland in your team. And I think what we've seen from City has been a lot more tempo-based stuff this season, because I think usually with Man City, the tempo side of things has been always slow the game down, even in the advanced areas. So this idea that, you know, you play the ball up, you play someone like Jack Grealish, because Jack Grealish never loses the ball, and so you can protect possession, keep the ball for as long as possible. So it means that you're not in those situations where you've turned the ball over and you're going to be facing a sort of dangerous counter-attack.
Yeah.
I think what we've seen happen this season is that actually Guardiola has accepted that changes of tempo and actually attacking quite quickly can be quite dangerous, especially when you have a player like Erling Haaland, right? The big part of his upside is that you can play the ball in behind to a player like that who, you know, more often than not is going to score compared to other players. And so the big thing about Guardiola now having this unit of defenders, like five centre-backs in a pentangle.
Pentagon?
No, it's pentangle now.
Isn't a pentangle like a five-pointed star or something? But anyway, like a lot of that, I think, has gone from Guardiola going the other way, right? Before, he wanted to stop any of these dangerous counterattacks happening. And now he's just saying, okay, these are going to happen. We can be better set up to counterattack versus other teams than they are against us. And that's, you know, because we have the better players in this situation, we're actually going to come out on top more often than not. And I think that's what his Champions League approach has sort of come down to, because last season they had that patient approach in the Champions League and they got knocked out anyway. And I think he's just saying now, well, let's just fall in and try and beat these teams at their own game a little bit.
Pentangle are a British folk band formed in London in 1967. The original band was active in the late 60s and early 70s. There's a version been active since the 80s. You could probably go and see them now.
The name Pentangle was chosen to represent the five members of the band and is on the device of Sir Gawain's shield in the Middle English poem Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which is obviously an inspiration for Pep Guardiola.
Yeah, the Green Knight. Who's that?
Jolly Green Knight.
There's a man on the jars of peas, isn't he?
Yeah. Sweet Green Corn, I think it was.
He's a jolly
Green Giant or something.
Green Giant.
Yeah.
Well, what would...
Sorry, I...
Do you know my first thought was there? What would Batman do with the Jolly Green Giant was rampaging through the city? And it's like so stupid.
Yeah.
Why do I...
What would
you do, though?
What would the ethos of the Jolly Green Giant be? Like, what would he...
What the hell is Jolly... Why is he there?
He's a guy who advertises sweet corn.
But that's yellow.
Yeah, but
he's green.
Green giant.
Yeah.
Was he a former normal boy who ate so much corn he became a green giant?
Yeah, probably. You will stop that giant from destroying Gotham, Master Bruce. You will stop him from doing it.
Where is the other corn going? Yeah? Rachel! Green giant! Yeah. Anyway.
There's a jolly green giant statue in Blue Earth, Minnesota.
Is there? Of the actual lad?
Yeah.
Oh. Why are you commissioning that? Who's commissioning that?
The Valley of the Jolly Green Giant refers to the Minnesota River Valley around La Sueur. I have no idea how Americans pronounce that. There you go.
And we'll never know. So as we were talking about Brighton saying how, oh sorry, Guardiola and how he has better players than everyone else, therefore he can do certain things, but it's not as simple as that. It's much more complicated, but if you reduce it, you can say that. Brighton don't have all of the best players, yet the players they do have look amazing. And these young lads they've brought through have really, that would be really, really impressive. But then it looks very much like Alexis McAllister will leave in the summer and Moises Caicedo. It looks like they'll probably go. But I expect, and I think we should all expect, that they'll replace them with good players because they're a very well-run club. And there was this thing we're talking about last week, John, where essentially we're looking at the idea of being a mid-table club, and it's sort of along the lines of, like, my idea is, like, what is the point of supporting one of these teams that's never actually going to win? Because the whole point of supporting a football team, surely, is to win stuff. Now, I support Aberdeen. All we can possibly win is maybe a cup some of the time. That's kind of it. But if you support Crystal Palace, what's the point?
I often ask myself that.
No, but genuinely.
But so, I mean, obviously, there's the whole, you know, community thing. You feel part of a tribe and that kind of enjoyment of football. Mm-hmm. For the last 10 years, barring that one season, the only point has been to enjoy Wilfred Zaha, entertain. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's where we find our joy because we've never won a trophy. But I do think that...
That can't be... You never won a trophy, really?
Never won a trophy. Oh, we won some, like, tin pot pre-season thing, but never, ever won a trophy. Got to a few cup finals. But it's the idea that when you do eventually win that trophy, it will feel...
But it's never going to happen, Ruben. There's a thing, maybe
don't
like part
crush
of it
my dreams.
Is getting into Europe, like Brighton have, and then you get to go on a jolly with your pals, and that's quite fun.
Yeah.
But you're not going to win.
No, but that's like, do you see that clip? Well, I'm sure we'll come on to Liga shortly, but do you see that video of in the Lens Stadium, they played the Champions League theme tune and had like loads of fireworks and everyone was lighting up their phones and stuff. It looked magical. Like, that is the dream for people like me who support those middling teams that maybe threaten to get into Europe.
Oh, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I fully understand this part of it, right? So if Aberdeen were to get the Champions League, I wouldn't believe, and like, it would be amazing. I'd love to watch that. And I'm sure Crystal Palace, same thing if you got into there. But like things like Brighton, so like, basically trying to get back into the point where we're going with this is that the point is to try and win, right? We'll accept that is sort of the point. And winning might count as getting the Champions League.
Yeah, it's all relative, but yes, the point is to win.
But then, like, what some teams will do, like maybe Brighton, is overachieve. So maybe a team overachieves, which then means they become a bigger deal, right? Which means they can then attract a bigger name manager than, well, Deserby's a big name, but you know, he'll go into something else at some point, and different players. And that and then affects their recruitment and decision making upon what kind of manager they get and what kind of players. And then that actually makes a mess of what they're trying to achieve.
I think Leicester are the great example, right?
Right.
Because Leicester changed the position that people traditionally thought that they should inhabit. I mean, they were almost relegated one season and then won the Premier League the following season. And I think when those sorts of things happen, a lot of people expect there to be smart reasons for why that was the case. And I think sometimes you can just get lucky. Leeds, another great example, right? We got Marcelo Bielsa and that gave us three seasons of like brilliant football. And then now look where we're at. But I think that the big question that I have with a team like Brighton is, like, why is it that they are where they are? Because I don't feel as though Brighton are where they are now because they've short-term overachieved. And I think so much of it comes to, you've already mentioned their recruitment. They have really smart recruitment ideas. They do this really nice buy-to-loan principle that they adopt, which is you bring in players. The players that they want to play for them, if they brought them in when they were succeeding, they'd be way too expensive for a team like Brighton. So what they try and do is they try and buy them before they've succeeded to get them cheaper. And the idea is you buy those players in and then you loan them out somewhere else in clubs where you expect them to actually develop. And then when they've started to hit the potential that you saw them potentially having, you can then bring them into your first 11. And that's what they've largely done with a lot of these players. So someone like Alexis McAllister was bought very early on in Argentina and loaned back to, I think, a couple of clubs that before he actually played for Brighton. We saw the same happening with Caicedo as well. And that's the model that they adopt. So there's principles behind what they're doing that are long-term principles. And I think we're starting to see the benefits of that. The big question is going to be, how do they manage being one of these bigger sides now? If they are going to consistently operate at that level, are they going to do what Leicester did, which is bring in someone like Brendan Rodgers, who then actually wants to have increasing influence on the recruitment side of things? And actually that becomes detrimental to them. And
yeah,
I think
the
thing with Brighton is, we were saying this before we started recording, is that they have very clear ideas about the remits of each of the different departments they have. So they have a coach. His job is to coach the players and get them performing as well as they can on the pitch. They have a recruitment department whose job it is to bring in the players that sort of fit the game model that the club have. They'll have a back room staff, front office staff who will be doing a lot of the the off-pitch strategy stuff as well. And the idea should be that each of those departments has a clear identity and is making the decisions to protect the other departments from having to make those kind of decisions. So you end up with specialists in each of those departments making the best possible decisions so that, you don't end up doing this thing where one person suddenly has all of the influence and can end up, pulling a team apart.
Well, do you know what? Even on Brighton, so if you imagine now, so they've achieved sixth place, right? So how do they get better? The way to get better now is to bring in probably players better than what you have. So those are going to be really expensive because we know the model is you buy them, you send them out for maybe a year, then they come back. Like Alexis McAllister is an exact example of that, I think. And then Mitoma he's older than you think Mitoma. He's like 24 or something like that because he was at university in Japan and then stayed there for a little bit while to do a degree rather than go straight into professional football. But the college level football is really good there. Just this is all information that I'm sure you'll love. And so if they want to then improve and try and get to the next bit, which is Champions League level, they need to buy better players. But doing that goes against
the model, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Because yeah. that what's the how but do they do it? What do
isn't
they do?
The point though that they've got players that are going to be worth 50, 60, 70 million pounds
yeah.
through their model, and so it's almost as though they just need to keep doing what they're doing
because they've got to keep them, don't they, so they can keep getting better.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a risk involved with if you're a selling club. But at the same time, and again, like a big question is going to be like, can we keep a couple of these players maybe a little bit longer than we might have priced into our model?
Yes.
I guess. But at the same time, I think that in these situations that you have to have the confidence that your model has got you where you are. And as a result of that, you have to keep using the model. So I mean, it's more like Mark Cucurella and Graham Potter leave for Chelsea this season. And
how did that go?
Brighton got better, right? So it's so easy to become like elite club pilled and just be like, well, now we're an elite club, we have to do things the way that other elite clubs do.
Yeah.
But I think there's an argument to be made that Brighton could maintain this sort of level just using their current model. Now, that doesn't mean to say that they won't have the potential for a few years where their recruitment doesn't come through. And then there might be some seasons where they variance a little bit lower. But at the same time, I think that they just have to keep up with this because if they don't, they can be in the situation of a team like Leicester where they, all it takes is a couple of bad seasons, the pandemic, everything falls to pieces and then suddenly your squad's basically worthless and they're not performing at the level that you want and you can't change the manager because you don't have the money and stuff. So
it's a bit like Southampton. Remember when they had a bit of a time before and they were finishing like sixth?
They got into Europe, didn't they? Yeah. I was just about to use them as an example of like a cautionary tale of when you stop finding these gems. Like their model was a bit different to Brighton's, wasn't it? Because they weren't like plucking players out of South America and then loaning them out, but they were finding good value around Europe with players like Mane.
Yeah, they're using the Football Manager scouting database. Yeah. Vertonghen, not going to sign him yet.
It was Toby Alderweireld.
That's what I meant. Yeah,
yeah. And Wanyama and players like that. And then eventually they stopped replacing these great players with even better players and they just got worse and worse. But maybe that was a staffing recruitment thing.
I think, again, though, it's to do with every department actually benefiting the others. And the reason why Southampton did quite well is because Maurizio Pochettino came through and they had a bit of a purple patch in terms of on-field performances. That is going to naturally raise a lot of the levels of your player. So that's the key reason why you have to spread the risk, I think, because you can't just rely on, oh, we had a good manager, he raised the level of the value of our players and then we lived off that value for a few seasons. It has to be constantly, all the time. Okay, we got rid of Graham Potter, we bring in Roberto De Zerbi, we have a plan for who we bring in if Roberto De Zerbi is picked up. We're going to sell this player for this amount of money in the right conditions, and then we're going to make sure that we reinvest that money properly. We're going to reinvest it in the training facilities and our scouting networks.
Do you know what, this sounds like a really well-run business.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, right? And then that's sort of what a lot of these clubs have become, these big massive ones, because what are they going to win? Maybe a cup? Hmm. Is that good enough for? I don't know. It's kind of that.
Yeah,
profitability.
Like, I get
great,
it, right?
But what's the end goal?
Amazing for Brighton fans, like amazing, and it's the best Brighton team we've ever seen. They've got really good players, but they'll sell Caicedo, they'll sell McAllister, and then they've got to bring in like Chelsea, right? Absolute mess, but they've signed players. They couldn't do the same thing Brighton are doing, maybe, because they need to buy players that are now, like really now, and they can attract the bigger names, which are in theory better players, but not always.
JJ, very sorry to interrupt, mate. Since you mentioned Chelsea, I was going to mention it in the break, but it's relevant now. We've literally had Pochettino just confirmed.
Is that right?
Really?
Yeah. So just in the context of the conversation.
Oh, isn't this very exciting?
2-year contract, option of a third year.
Wow.
It's quite short, isn't it?
Oh, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, good for them.
He cut me off, Ruben, but it was for good reason. In Steve, we trust.
Mm, absolutely.
What do you think of Pochettino at Chelsea then? Tell me after a break.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
We're back after the breaking news of Maurizio Pochettino, who has officially, we knew it a while ago, but he's signed now officially, so they've announced it. Ruben, I started asking you the question, so I will allow you to answer. Is he going to rescue Chelsea?
Oh, big question, big question.
Yes.
No, not entirely.
And we're, that's the end of the podcast today.
I started, so I'll finish. not immediately, but I think they could do a lot worse than Pochettino. Like, he took a kind of underwhelming Spurs team to very much overachieving. Obviously, it all depends on whether they thin the squad out and give him like a manageable group of players and a balanced one as well. I am optimistic that he will get Raheem Sterling back to good form and use him in a similar way that he used Son at Spurs. Maybe. But like the top end of the table is so much more competitive now than it was the last time Chelsea were elite.
That's a really
right?
good point. And like, also, we've just talked about really well
Newcastle,
clubs,
right?
Yeah.
The top six is now the top seven in terms of like finance. And then you've got the disruptors like Brighton. So it's going to be very difficult, but I don't know why he's taken it, really. It doesn't look like an appealing job to me.
Do you reckon? Isn't that job still appealing?
I don't know. It looks difficult. It's more appealing than a Spurs job, to be fair. Right now, my overwhelming feeling regarding Pochettino going to Chelsea is that I feel sorry for my Spurs supporting friends because it stings.
John, you did a video on Pochettino to Chelsea and what he would do and how he would save them. Do you think the job's appealing still? It must be, right?
I mean, we've just seen two very highly touted coaches not really succeed. I mean, Tuchel obviously wins the Champions League, but in this season, Tuchel really struggled to get anything out of the squad that they have. It's a squad that has been built for, I think, a back three system. And the problem is that, you know, most elite coaches aren't playing with a back three. So you're going to bring in a coach who's playing a back four system and try and squeeze it in. Graham Potter turns up, tries to fit a back four system in somehow. Obviously, with Potter and Tuchel, you're going to have like flexibility between a back three.
Yeah,
and
the four becomes a three.
Yeah, in certain situations. But it's still a back three system. Graham Potter, obviously, didn't succeed, and a lot of people put that down to him not being at the elite level. But then we've seen Frank Lampard come in, and hey, no one's pretending Frank Lampard is an elite manager, but he's had an absolutely awful record there as well. So I think with that context, the idea of turning up at a club where, as Ruben's already said, like, yes, the squad is built for a back three system probably. It's also a squad which has like had £500-600 million spent on it recently and will need to be thinned down in some way. So you're in a situation where you've got a squad which needs work on it, but not a huge amount of wiggle room to do that work. And the last two proper managers who've taken the job have struggled in it. So I think, yeah, very unappealing. But then the appeal is that all of these managers think I can fix it, right? That's what they think. That's why they are elite coaches. So I think, yes, it's an appealing job, but I don't think it should be an appealing job.
From a leadership point of view, they're like quite close to losing important players as well. Like Mount is being linked with a move away. Is Azpilicueta off at the end of this season?
Well, I'm not sure.
But if he's not, he's only got a year left. And then, you know, Thiago Silva's getting on a bit. So it's a very young...
Yeah, a big vacuum of leadership. Yeah. And then I keep reading things about how all training's not been as intense as it's supposed to be. And that like, that all apply on the pitch. So Pochettino is one of the things you keep reading about him is that he very much makes you work hard on the training ground.
He's a hands-on coach.
Yeah, you see that applied in real games, right? So then you might get... If you can turn that into a team, like they're talking about these big clubs or medium clubs that can't really break through, the ceiling for Chelsea is not even one. It's an open top roof.
Yeah.
You could, it's stratospheric. You could go to the moon if you want, but you have to get it right. So I guess that's the appeal, and also probably a bit of ego showing that you are the real deal. Back in the Premier League, you can do that sort of thing there.
Incredibly. I think one of the things that's hamstrung them a lot this season, other than like a complete absence of any good tactics, is Reece James's injury. Or repeated injuries, because despite the squad having a million players in it, they only have one proper orthodox young right wing back who can move. Because Azpilicueta,
he's their best player as well.
Azpilicueta, legend of the club, used to be brilliant. Doesn't quite have the legs to play at wing back or attack that much. And without James, this entire squad just kind of is missing this really key part. So maybe the arrival of Malo Gusto will help fix that.
I wonder how much influence what has happened at Arsenal will have on other clubs as well, because it felt as though they just sort of had to eat it for a few seasons and accept that it was going to be difficult for them to start challenging at the top rather than...
Do you mean in terms of like holding on to a manager and building?
Exactly. Whereas I feel as though the overriding sense I've got from Chelsea and their fans this season is that if it's not an easy fix, we're not interested. But I don't think there is an easy fix now. And I think that's not to say that they should have, you know, stayed with some of the managers they've had, but I think they do have to have a long-term view here and accept that, you know, after finishing whatever, they finished 12th this season?
Yeah, we finished 11th.
Crystal Palace,
of course.
Crystal Palace have finished ahead of Chelsea. If there's anything you take away from this podcast episode, it is that. But when you finish 12th, I think you've just got to accept, right, we need to have a long term vision here now. The rest of the teams that we're considering ourselves as our peers are well ahead of where we're at in terms of their evolutions. And so it may be the case that, you know, you have to have the faith to stick with Pochettino for the 2 years that he's been offered the contract for, and there is a possibility of a third year as well. But that's what they need to do. They need to stick with a manager for 2 years now. And even if it doesn't work out, you hope that there are certain, you know, structures and infrastructures in place that actually allow you then to make the next step when the next manager comes in.
That impatience does kind of make sense to an extent, doesn't it? Given what they had in the Abramovich era with the managers that they hired and the fact that they basically all won a trophy in the first or second season. And then
it does strike me very much as like, so if you're listening, you can't see that Ruben is wearing a heart shirt from Succession, right? So the hit show Succession.
Show the back.
Waystar Royco is the there we go. Very good. Succession series 3. So the whole point here for me is that like Chelsea, there's a lot of similarity in that. They've come in with this lots of money, just ploughed money into the club, thinking it'll work straight away. It hasn't, and it really looks like an expensive, like a big risk they've taken here. Not quite the same as them buying Hearts. There's obviously lots of things to that, but that's what we've seen. It's not a particularly. It doesn't look well run at the moment. It's every chance because these people won't be daft, but they can turn that into a winning team. Pochettino is the kind of manager who can definitely do that. We've seen him do it in the past. But speaking of other kind of slightly badly run clubs, if we can call them that, Leicester City and John's beloved Leeds are going down. that when they are down, right? So they've gone.
No, we're currently going down. We get down as soon as the championship
get
kicks
down,
off.
So get down.
We're currently going down.
Burrup, burrup.
Just slowly, really slowly.
That's probably where copyright was. Yeah.
That's much closer to copyright.
I think I'm in the right key, though. Anyway, so this summer, Leicester are going to lose a heap of players for free, basically. Roughly, they spent about £110 million in transfer fees buying them. But if you look through who they actually had them written down here. Yeah, so the players that are going out of contract, Ryan Bertrand, doesn't really matter too much. Johnny Evans has been really important to them. You get a leadership void, you lose him if he goes. Nampolis Mendy, Daniel Amati, Yuri Tielemans, Kaglar Tsiontchu.
Iose Perez is a Leicester player, and he tweeted, you'll be back, like as an encouraging kind of message to Leicester. He's still technically a Leicester player, and he's calling them you, which is worse than me calling Palace we.
He's just trying to separate himself. He's just trying to separate himself from them. He's like, no, it wasn't me. I wasn't part of that. It's quite bad for them, right? So obviously it went down to the wire. The last game of the season, you had Everton managed to beat Bournemouth, didn't they? Yes. So that kept them up. So Leicester, even though they won, doesn't matter. They were gone. So there's nothing they could do about that. And it is just, I mean, they spent a lot of money. It's been badly run. They've not sold players when they maybe should have done. Maybe they didn't get the offers that they wanted. But that is then now down. And they lost a lot of players now going forward. And I said to you this morning, John, that they'll be straight back up again, won't they? They've got some decent players there, but they're losing quite a lot. They've got to rebuild. That's really complicated.
This is a really good example of what we were talking about before, being like, shouldn't you keep your best players and not sell them, right? Leicester have done that. You look at the players in their squad and you think there's no way this team should be going down. But I think that's a classic example of like why you should stick with your models and say, okay, sell your players when they're, you know.
Buy a low, sell high.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think the Leicester thing has been a mess. I think there shouldn't have been any reason why this team got relegated. And the trajectory under Brendan Rodgers has been quite frankly awful. And I think he shoulders a lot of that blame. I think, you know, they missed out on Champions League for a couple of seasons and then they've simply plummeted down the table. And it's what we were talking about before, is that allowing the manager to have too much influence in a separate department actually can
recruitment specifically, I think.
Recruitment, yeah. Specifically, yeah.
They didn't have much money to spend for a long time, so like I'll defend Rodgers for a little bit there, because they didn't have an awful lot of money, and then they did, and they signed a bunch of
nonsense.
But
do we not think that, again, that is partly his responsibility, is what we said before, is that if you have a good manager who raises the value of players and then you sell them on, you're generating, you know, that's part of your transfer strategy as a club, is to bring in a manager who makes the players worth more than they should be. I mean, again, we'll talk about Leeds, but Leeds are a classic example of that. People didn't think that the Leeds squad was good until Bielsa arrived, and we generated a huge amount of value out of them there. And then the story of the post-Bielsa decline has been now watching those players who so many of us were you know, mean so much to so many of us. It's sad just seeing the decline that has happened there. And I think, again, that you just have to... It's a brutal industry, football, right? You have to kill your babies or whatever they say. Like, you have to let these things go. And if you don't do that, if you're sentimental, then you end up where Leicester have ended up now.
That's the theory, right? To succeed at anything in life, really, you've got to be a psychopath.
Yeah.
You don't have feelings or don't care about anything.
Isn't it kill your darlings, not kill your babies, just to be...
Is it?
Please don't kill me.
Well...
That wasn't convincing.
Should clubs deprioritize the manager in terms of authority and in terms of who is to blame?
Maybe. Managers get sacked because it's the easiest solution to a normally more widespread, more complicated problem. Yeah, it's like you change one person, but you hope it has a much more significant effect than that, because you can't sell and replace the whole squad.
It's making me think that, like, basically director of football and the stuff in the office, like the office part, is so much more important than, obviously we probably realise this, but you look at, like, I mean, Leeds and Leicester as an example. So Leeds had Jesse Marsh in place doing whatever he was doing. They signed a bunch of players that are designed to play around him and get his style of football to work the way it possibly could if it was going to work. Then they killed him. And then they had all these players left over, and I've forgotten whose name he came in, Javi Garcia.
Yeah.
So he came in, different kind of manager, but had all these players suited to play one style, and they're footballers, right? They can adapt. But it's this doesn't work. Whereas Leicester had Brendan Rodgers in place and they'd built a squad around Brendan Rodgers, which was getting relegated. And then, I don't know.
So to answer your question, yeah, clubs should deprioritise manager. And you need to build an environment where if a manager, like when Potter just got poached, that somebody else can come in and just make it work and build. And obviously, like, you need a certain type of manager depending on what you want to do. But yeah, the aim should be to create an environment where personnel can change, but everything keeps going on the same direction. Yeah,
I think Leeds is a great example there, because what's happened has been that Victor Orta has once Marcelo Bielsa's moved on, he's gone. There's a different play style that we could adopt in the Premier League that will allow us to get economic benefits that other teams won't be getting. Because the idea is that you play a really intense approach to football, and in theory, players who are maybe physically elite are going to be cheaper than players who are technically elite. Because obviously, technically elite players can win you games through, you know, just being really good at football.
Rare, so
yeah, exactly. And so the idea is right, we're going to build a squad. We're going to bring in a manager who plays that intense style of play. We're going to build a squad to suit that. And what's become very apparent midway through the season is actually this isn't going to work for whatever reason. So get rid of the coach and then bring in two other coaches who are not suited to manage a squad of very low-tech as players. Now, there's been a lot of people on social media talking about why, if Leeds had kept Jesse Marsh, they would have had a better chance of staying up. And that's absolutely true. But that's because Leeds spent upwards of £150 million building the perfect team for that guy. And he left in 17th. You know, we were in 17th when he left.
So didn't he leave like just after the January window as well?
Yeah, after the January. I mean, it was just terribly. But the part of the problem is that Victor Orta, who was the director of football at the time, was backing Jesse Marsh all the way. And he would have been pointing at the underlying numbers and saying, Leeds aren't as bad as everyone's saying they are. If we keep with this coach, then we will stay up. But I think what has happened there then has been very much the director of football keeping things to a point at which we reached a point of no return. And then they moved the manager on, eventually moved on the director of football because he, like you say, the buck has to stop with him as well. But then the only option you have is to bring in other coaches who can play that intense style of play. And the issue is that style of play hasn't worked in the Premier League. So the whole thing is a mess. Leeds are where they're at because they made a gamble at the beginning of the season and threw a load of money at it, and it hasn't worked out. And now we're going down with a squad that is built for, you know, a completely different style of football. And so there's a sense in which it's good that Leeds are going down because it will force them to have to rebuild that squad again, rethink about what their game model is, rethink about what the tactical identity of the team that they want to build is going to be. But that's a clear example of the director of football making a decision which impacted the whole of the season. And regardless of how you blame whatever managers followed, it all came down to this idea that we were going to throw all of our eggs into one basket in a bid to sort of be smart, and it hasn't worked out.
The Premier League is a cruel mistress.
Well, I'll tell you somewhere else it's a cruel mistress. The Bundesliga. Let's do a European tour. Now, if you haven't seen this, basically, Borussia Dortmund absolutely fucked it. All they had to do to win the Bundesliga for the first time in 11 years, is it 12 years, 11 years, was beat Mainz, who finished ninth the season, for context. Are Mainz good, John?
Mainz have had a good season. They've sort of tailed off a little bit recently. But they are a good, you know, they're not the sort of team that you want to.
Dortmund should have beaten them.
Dortmund should have beaten them at home, yes.
So there you go.
The players that they have.
So all they had to do is win. They didn't. And so therefore, Bayern Munich win the league again, but on goal difference. But
they almost bottled it as well, didn't they?
Did they?
Well, FC Köln equalised, and it took a very late Musiala winner for them to clinch it.
That Musiala goal is actually incredible.
Yeah, it's really
when
good.
You consider the situation that is unfolded. He, you know, it's like the last few minutes of the game, picks the ball up, dribbles and hits it from the edge of the box, curls it in, bottom corner. And I guess that's the difference, right? It's been Dortmund bottling it and Musiala just, you know.
I read something.
Coming up clutch.
You know, we talked about the economic, the thing, the wages thing, that's finishing top. Bayern Munich's wage bill compared to everyone else's is just ridiculous. Like, they're so far ahead of everyone. It's why you can kind of usually predict who's going to win the league, which is why it's such a shame that Dortmund did not. I'm sure Bayern fans are very happy. But like, after Bayern won it, they went nuts and fired Oliver Kahn, Hasan Salihamidzic. Didi Hamann was talking, and he says that he thinks Thomas Tuchel might even go now as well. He only just got there a few games ago. But the more interesting thing in the Bundesliga is the team that John plays for, Freiburg. you're playing in the Europa League this season, John. That's exciting.
That's right. We played in the Europa League last season. We're at that point, aren't we? Uh-huh. Where we're talking last season, this season, and some like La Liga is still ongoing, right? Is
yeah.
That right?
Yeah, so, it's, yeah, it's still this season.
Still this season.
The cup, cup finals haven't happened yet.
But yeah, both Freiburg and Union Berlin. Union Berlin got Champions League football, which is quite frankly nuts.
Why is that nuts? Because I don't even know. So I do know, but pretend I don't, for the audience.
Union Berlin were promoted a couple of seasons ago, and everyone expected them to go straight back down. And their coach, Urs Fischer, has done a really fantastic job, and they've pretty much been in the Champions League conversation for the last couple of seasons, as have Freiburg. But Freiburg have done it a little bit slower burn. Freiburg are really great. Freiburg basically the Brighton of Germany, in the sense that they're a team who has a very clear idea of how they're going to buy players, move them on. So most Freiburg teams each season will have a player who just immediately moves on. Even if, so for example, Nico Schlotterbeck moved to Dortmund last summer. He'd been at Freiburg for a little while, but only played one full season really for us, was really good in that season, and then was sold immediately at the end of that season. Kevin Schade, who we talked about, you know, with the Brentford goal, mm-hmm. He literally came through the youth system at Freiburg this season and has been sold for a record fee to Brentford as well. So very much the case that if they get and it's not even like a big offer, like these, we're talking like 20, 30 million pounds. These players just get immediately moved on. And there's a list of some of them, like Chalo Sionchu was a Freiburg player. Robin Koch at Leeds was a Freiburg player. They're the two famous Premier League ones, but there's been a few other ones as well. Vincenzo Grifo moved from Freiburg. He's actually back there now as well. But Matthias Ginter, same as well, actually moved from Freiburg and has come back recently from Borussia Dortmund. But very much the case that, you know, even if you have a player who carries you to this sort of position, they'll sell them at the end of the season. But like the beginning of this season, Freiburg got Europa League football, and I was convinced that we were going to be in a probably finish mid-table because we just don't have the squad to compete in two competitions. And yet we got knocked out by Juventus in the knockout stages of the Europa League.
It's probably because they were playing a 37-year-old John McKenzie in midfield.
That's right, yeah. But and they've still made it to the Europa League again this season. So it's just testament to what we've been saying for the whole of this podcast, really, that smart clubs can compete with teams that have a lot more.
But also that way. What eventually is the point, because it's so demoralising. Like, it's,
I don't know. I quite like. I'll be honest with you. Yeah. Supporting Leeds and Freiburg, Leeds who spent, you know, as we've said, upwards of £150 million to try and compete in the Premier League,
yeah,
and Freiburg who spend nothing every season. I much prefer supporting Freiburg because you look at that team and you say they have a plan and they operate in a way that, you know, it takes, they take everything seriously. And as a result, they take the fans seriously. And I thoroughly enjoy, Freiburg are never going to win the Bundesliga.
No one apart from Bayern seems to ever be able to.
But they may get to the Champions League. And, you know, that's enough for me. That's what I want to get out of it. And
I'm with you.
That.
Same with Aberdeen. Like, we're never going to win the league, but I still
turn up every
still
week.
Still tune in every week. Yeah. I still love it. Still, I mean, I guess as well, part of Sporting Football Club that we were talking about earlier is a little bit, it has become part of your identity. So you want it to represent a lot of what you do. So if they're doing things in the right, smart way, that sounds like a very John McKenzie thing to do. I sort of get it now. But that's the Bundesliga, right? So we know Bayern won. Borussia Dortmund should have, didn't. RB Leipzig will be in the Champions League as well, with Union Berlin, who we did not think they would get to that. So
they were in the title race chat for quite a while this season, weren't they?
Because they just didn't concede any goals. Mm. Yeah, they don't score many.
Only 9 points behind the winners in the end. Well, both pretty good.
Both Union and Freiburg have discovered defending, which I think helps useful in that league. Yeah,
I've always said that defending is useful.
Well, in La Liga, Barcelona won. So the league's not finished, but Barcelona won. They're currently 11 points clear, because they've won it, the league, of Real, obviously, in second. Were they actually any good?
Barca? Yeah, yeah. Xavi is clearly a good manager. He's got... Again,
they're not good when Pedri doesn't play, genuinely. Like, they don't create anything.
They do miss Pedri when he doesn't play, because the downgrade from him to, who would it be, Sergi Roberto, is, like, creatively is quite significant. But they do have a clear idea, and he's got... you know, John made a video about, was it Xavi using the box midfield earlier this season?
Yeah.
And
they did one as well.
And they've got Robert Lewandowski,
Yes.
And Ronald Araujo, who's obviously brilliant.
I think there's an argument to be made that Xavi's structural like box midfield thing was good because it just it gave him a structure to get his best players on the field.
Well, that's the whole mission, right? Get your best players on. Yeah. So like, you've got Busquets, Frankie De Jong, Gavi, and Pedri. So the only way to do it, like we discussed before, is that Gavi plays wide left, out of possession, but in possession comes in front of the box.
You've got one winger and then one fullback who end up kind of on the same line.
Alejandro
like
Balde.
Rafinha and Balde, who is class in only like 19 years old. I think they're going to sign a right back so that Koundé can move in field next season.
I mean, they've got to do a lot of stuff in the summer. So first of all, they're moving out of the camp now. So they're going because they're redeveloping it. So they're going to go and play. I've forgotten the name of it, but they're moving to the Olympic Stadium in Barcelona down the road, which has got basically half the capacity. So about 55,000, I think, rather than 99,000 for the camp now. I'm pretty sure I'm right with that. And developing what they've got. But like Sergio Busquets is leaving. It looks like Jordi Alba is also leaving. Yeah, so that's two huge players. It's basically all the last... Busquets was the last of the Pep Guardiola players. And then Alba would have been Luis Enrique and maybe...
Alba was just missed Pep, didn't he?
Yeah. So that's kind of the end of that. But we've got Real Madrid might also be about to change what they're doing because Carlo Ancelotti linked away constantly. Might go to Brazil, is that the current kind of rumour, which would be pretty fun.
That seems like all parties involved want that move to happen, but none of them are going to... make it happen because it's all, you know, it's contracts and money and it's like, well, if you want to go, you go. And it's like, well, if you don't want me to...
You don't want to give up the Real Madrid job either.
No, or the payout. So,
Well, how about Atletico, Ruben? Because they
could still finish second, couldn't they?
Right, like,
They're only a point behind Madrid with a game to go. They've improved, like, they've quietly been very good for like this half of the season, I think.
So there was talk of Simeone maybe being the way out early in the season. Yeah.
I think the two most significant things that happened to enable that are that Griezmann was allowed to play a full 90 because you remember he kept on coming on with half an hour to go because of some weird clause in his loan from Barcelona. So they just changed that to a full transfer for like half the agreed fee so that they could get rid of that.
And the other one was that Eddie Howe started haunting Diego Simeone.
Yes, that as well.
In his living in his walls, giving him advice for tactics. Is that right?
Yes, precisely. And Eddie Howe's ghost said to Diego Simeone, switch to a back three.
Is that right?
Yeah. So then Diego Simeone plays this like kind of hybrid back three where he's got Carrasco as a left wing back, who's obviously more of an orthodox winger. Witzel tucks into defence as a centre back, and then more of an orthodox right back on that side. So they can still do that 4-4-2, which he's associated with when they want to. But it gets it allows them
gets
to
gets all of their best players on.
Yeah,
the
it gets all their best players, which allows them to attack a bit differently. Griezmann and Morata have a really nice relationship. Like Morata has scored 13 goals this season, which for him is pretty good.
Yeah.
And Griezmann's got 15, playing a very different role to the one that he played for France at the World Cup.
And Atletico win every game 1-0, right? So they don't need to score as well. That's basically, what would you say, 12 and 15? That's basically 30 wins.
Yeah, I mean, they used to win every game 1-0, but recently they've been banging in the goals. They beat Cadiz 5-1 and they beat Valladolid 5-2 the weekend before.
Simeone must be turning in his grave.
I was starting to think when you said we got all the best players on the team, that's kind of how it's worked, right? So you've got the best players on. That makes it sound like being a manager is very easy. So if Pochettino at Chelsea can just find a way to get 55 players on the pitch at the same time.
But last thing on Atletico Madrid, they're such a fascinating team because it feels like Simeone is constantly battling with his instinct to be defensively solid and kind of do that. And because they're a big club and they're successful, it's like, now we have this, we have to evolve, right? So then they've had so many flair players over the years that have joined and not been that good. And Thomas Lemar has come good for them, but he took a while to adapt.
Yeah.
And I think earlier on in the season, they were playing a much higher line. And I was reading about their tactics this morning, and they've just moved it back a little bit, which makes players like Jimenez and Witzel and Savage more comfortable defending like that. So it's a constant battle between trying to evolve and be more dominant and then sticking to what made them good in the first place. And it's like, it's this seesaw. It's bizarre.
Yeah, like what happens after Simeone, because it could be one of those things, like he's been there for so long now that it could all go wrong. But we'll sum up La Liga, right? So Barca top, Real Madrid or Atletico could finish second. Pretty good achievement for Atletico. They can pull that off. Real, not obviously great. Looks like Real Sociedad are going to be fourth. So good for them. Champions League football, I think you have 4 spots in Spain. Then Villarreal fifth. Real Betis are sixth. And Osasuna, I was in Sevilla recently, and Osasuna were playing Real in the cup final. It was full of Osasuna fans. There were loads of them coming back to where, what's the point of supporting a team other than Barca or Real?
It's quite an amazing story.
Tell you
story.
What, they loved it. There was loads of them.
It's quite an amazing story. They've come right from the brink of disaster to come back up to finishing seventh, which is very impressive.
Pretty amazing. Well, they could still drop down a little bit because there's other teams like Sevilla, speaking of, they're just below them. But that's basically La Liga. You can look at the tables online if you have the internet. If you haven't heard of it yet, you'll like it. I'm a big fan.
It's going to be massive.
I think it's going to be big things that come out of the internet. Okay, and that's one to Serie A, which is the Pirate League. Serie A. And what we have here is Blackbeard be top of the Pirate League.
Who would be the top of the Pirate League?
Blackbeard
definitely.
Yeah. Redbeard.
Redbeard, not as good.
Be second.
It's the Redbeards versus the Blackbeard.
Bluebeard be
Bluebeard tree. Was one, wasn't he?
Yeah, was he? No,
isn't Bluetooth? Bluetooth wasn't he? Oh no, he was a Viking. Bluetooth.
He was, yeah.
Yeah.
Then Wi-Fi in fourth.
AOL dial-up internet connection sound in fifth.
I wonder what pirates do if they had Wi-Fi.
It's been a tough few years for that.
Yeah. Anyway, what actually happened was Napoli won the league. They've still got a game to go in Italy, don't they? But because they've got 20 teams, of course. So I remember when it used to be less than that. It was 18 back in the day, wasn't it? Back in... Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so Napoli won the league. They were excellent all season. And now Luciano Spalletti is going to take a gap year and go to Thailand for a bit, presumably, and hang
Tuscany,
about.
Tuscany, I think.
No, on his farm. He's got a farm.
He's got a farm?
Yeah, he's going to go to his or vineyard or something like that. Yeah, that so he's going to be up magic. In the hills. Yeah,
quite nice.
Spalletti, like, people don't know him, like, hugely influential with tactics and all things. He's really important to European football, but he's now going to be out for a year. But what happens next, John? Because they're likely going to get stripped apart, right?
Yeah, I mean, hasn't the story for Serie A been over the last few seasons that it's very competitive and we've seen a different winner of the league for, I don't know how many league seasons it is.
At least three.
Three or four, yeah. I could see Napoli not winning it next season quite comfortably. And it could be, anyone.
It's quite good, though. And the anyones are like Lazio, Inter Milan, AC Milan, Atalanta. I'm not supposed to say Inter Milan, am I? I'm supposed to say Inter, but it doesn't matter. Atalanta, Roma, Juventus. Torino could be in there.
Fiorentina have had a great season as well under Vincenzo Italiano.
Yeah,
Vinny Italy. So yeah, there's lots of potential twists and turns in Serie A next season.
I think Napoli won't be as good if they do lose like that defender Kim.
Well, Osimhen goes,
yeah, it's big losses. So we can see that all change. We'll see what Inter and Milan are like next season. Lazio, I didn't realize they'd managed to climb up to second. Who plays for them? Who's good for them?
Well, they've got Maurizio Sarri as their coach, have they not? And Ciro Immobile.
Yes.
Ciro Immobile.
He just bangs goals in Italy, nowhere else.
I'm getting a call through from copyright. copyright
we can't
police.
Be copyrighted by whoever wrote that opera, surely.
We should also say as well, it's an interesting story about Spalletti because Napoli sent an email to him saying your contract has been, we've activated the clause automatically without telling him in person. Yeah. And they were about to have dinner, him and, is it DeSantis, the owner?
De Laurentiis, sorry.
We're about to have dinner, like a day or two after. And he gets his email saying, your contract's been extended automatically. He's like, what? So he's just going to sit in the hills, work in his vineyard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, James Horncastle did a piece on The Athletic about it, which is really where I got the information
You should
from.
Read that piece.
Yes. Yeah.
Thanks, Steve, for that. That's a great input. Yeah. It's one of my favourite inputs.
Yeah, the whole season.
I don't know. What's your other favourite input? USB-C?
Not headphone jack.
We've not really had
headphone jack.
Not really
like headphone jack.
Headphone jack. We've not really had any evolution, have we, in terms of inputs? Like the USB-C, is that the most recent one?
What's your favorite input, Ruben? What do you like to input?
Lightning. Good old
control lightning.
Good old reliable charger.
Well, speaking of lightning, Lionel Messi plays for PSG in League One, League Un, or Un, what do you want to call it?
The honest of leagues.
Yes.
Ligue 1.
Now you might not believe this, Ruben, but PSG won the league this season.
No.
Well, is it even finished yet?
They didn't win it last season, did they?
No, it changes quite a lot, actually, which is the weird thing.
Was it Lille last season, or was that not the season before?
I thought it was last season.
It changes more than you think.
I know, Monaco won it as well.
Monaco won it in 16-17, and Lille won it either last season or season before.
Yeah.
But it's still not a surprise that PSG have won it, because they have all the money in the world.
What I think is maybe a surprise that Lyon's in a second, and we talked about this being a big celebration for them. Did we tell them the podcast or outside of the podcast?
No, I mentioned it earlier. Yeah.
So that's like, why is that a big achievement? Because they're not huge.
Well, because weren't they in the second division not too long ago? And to shoot up the league, that's the thing with Liga. Like the rest of it is quite competitive. Like if you do things smartly, you can break into the top four. You're just never going to win it. I feel a bit sorry for Cheikh Doucouré because Palace signed him last summer and we finished 11th, and his old mates have got into the Champions League.
But he did finish above Chelsea, and it's hard to understate that feeling.
We have to remind people that
finished above the teams below him.
Yeah, that's right.
He did. But yeah, fair play to Lens. Like that's an amazing achievement, and what an adventure they're going to have in Europe before they eventually come to the existential crisis of what's the point?
Well, exactly. And speaking of that, I mean, the point is that you get Ruben Pinder saying, well done.
And if that isn't motivation enough for French footballers...
Well, I don't know what is. Exactly. It's going to be an 18-team league next season in Liga. Do you know
that?
Well, I mean...
I wonder why that... What's the rationale behind that?
Well, let me tell you off the top of my head. Secondly, in view of the move to 18 clubs in the 23-24 season, the number of relegations to Ligue 2... Is that what you call it?
Yep.
No, it's League. They actually say League Two. It's really weird in France. Yeah.
League Duh. At the end,
they're sponsored by the number two in English.
Yes, yeah. And the letter B. I don't really know. They're just making it smaller. I don't know the answer to that. I can't talk about it at length in the podcast.
So they're relegating four teams.
We are normally quite professional. I don't feel like I've done my research on Liga, and so I'm going to move on to the Eredivisie. Arnie Slot won the league with Feyenoord. Didn't take the job at Spurs. Is he good, John?
Yes.
Quickly? Good. Yeah, okay. In Portugal, Benfica were ahead for ages. Then they sold Enzo Fernandes. Some other stuff happened and they held on, but they still won the league. So well done to Benfica.
Captained by Nicolas Otamendi.
Oh, there we go. Yes, he's there. Yeah. Still playing well.
Mm.
Gonçalo Ramos, I believe.
Yes.
He'll leave there soon. That other lad, Antonio Silva, the centre back they've got, is really good.
They still have Rafa Silva in attacking midfield as well. I remember you made a video about
him. I can't remember, actually. Maybe I should remember
and
that.
And West Ham legend João Mário.
Yeah, having the season of his life, he scored so many goals this season. He's been excellent, yeah. So that's what you've got.
It's a shame that Sporting didn't win the league, because this could have been the Spurs managerial hunt section of the podcast, right? With
Arne Slot, Ruben Amorim.
And Ange Postecoglou.
Of course, because in Scotland, Celtic obviously won the league with a goal difference of 80, which is pretty insane. there's only 12 teams in the league. Rangers finished second, surprise, 56 goal difference. Aberdeen finished third with a goal difference of -4. You ever seen that before?
That is quite rare.
We had just been on +1 before the weekend, though. How does that feel?
How
does that feel to you, JJ?
Well, as we know, the point of sporting football is it makes you miserable and you have feelings. So it reminds me to have feelings, because, as we know, to succeed, you have to be a psychopath and it's to true. Kill all in your way. And to support football means you have feelings and therefore you don't hurt anyone. So there we go. That's how we round up the entire podcast. That's it for the show this week. So I will say to you, Ruben Pinder, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure's all mine.
Yeah, it's more often you do that. I mean, it's a pleasure. Yeah. And thank you, John McKenzie.
Yes, thanks.
And thank you, Steve.
You're most welcome.
Thank you. And Jamie. That was Jamie's last studio show. Oh, well done, Jamie. Fantastic work. If you've watched the videos on YouTube, they're very hard to put together and edit. And Jamie and Don do a fantastic job of doing that. So I hope you're clapping in your car or the tube or wherever you are just now. Just applaud them right now. Maybe you're at home, you know?
Maybe you've just been shipwrecked off the coast of Italy as a rhino.
Maybe someone's tried to transport you to give to the Pope. Yeah.
In which case, still cheer.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you, listeners and viewers. Next week, it's the final one. Holy, that happened quickly, didn't it?
Yeah.
No more podcast, no more fun. You will be annoyed at us. What are you gonna do without the podcast? Listen to John's. It's gonna be great.
It's gonna be a fun show. The last studio podcast is gonna be good.
You think so?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it won't be very football-y. Not like this week's one was pretty.
Yeah.
Well, that's because it's just us three.
If anything, too much football this week.
And I think I've been pretty good at not going off rail.
Yeah.
It's hard to do that.
Good balance.
It's better when Joe's. I prefer when Joe's here. It is better when Joe's here, isn't it?
Well, so
shouldn't tell him that.
No.
Luckily, this isn't being recorded for him to hear.
He's not going to listen to it, is he?
I don't have thought so.
No.
So now it's quite a long podcast, isn't it, John? Will your podcast be this long, do you think?
Longer.
There you go. Mm. So for all the John McKenzie that you can possibly eat. Anyway, thanks everyone. Bye.
The Athletic.